big color, bigger savings. Sherwin-Williams Super Sale is here. Get 40% off paints and stains June 5th through the 11th with prices starting at $30.89. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
This week on Lunchbox Envy, the ancient Egyptians built giant ones to hatch eggs in.
Inventor Charles Babbage once tried cooking himself in one to see what would happen.
And when Julia Child started her career as a chef, she was so bad that she set hers on fire.
It's ovens! Hello and welcome to Lunchbox Envy. I'm Jack and I'm here with my fellow QI elf, Alex. How you doing?
Hello, I'm good. How are you?
Oh, great. Thank you.
You know who's not very good today?
No.
Manu.
Aww.
Off sick. So we have a replacement last minute podcast service.
Tis I.
Hello. Jamie Morton, podcasting legend.
Welcome.
I'm surprised you turned up because Jamie is an excellent cook and I've been to many a beautifully ovened roast at his before.
Yeah. Amazing.
And I was supposed to be at yours for dinner last night, but my work ran on so late that I just didn't turn up.
And he's such a social linchpin that the entire evening fell apart from
there. There was supposed to be like six people coming in.
Everyone was like, oh, actually, if Alex isn't going to be there, maybe I won't bother. Let's reschedule for January.
Yeah. I kind of imagined, okay. You know, there's like scenes in films where like the 1950s housewife like cooks for her husband, but he's off cheating the city. So she just sits silently in front of the roast for waiting for him to come back.
I was slaving, Jack. Slaving.
For your opinion.
All
yeah.
evening.
You love an oven roast. I've seen you. Yeah.
I do, yeah. I mean, when I was buying my house, my mum was very anti me getting a gas oven
yeah.
for environmental reasons.
I see.
But now, I really regret it because I feel like I can't do certain things.
Yeah.
With an electric oven than you can with a gas oven.
You can grill, I think, much more easily with a live flame because it literally gets hotter than the electric element.
But also, the thing I didn't realize about gas versus electric is they cook differently for moisture as well.
Yeah.
Because electric ovens create very dry heat, as you'd imagine, because any moisture in the air kind
very
of dries
dry.
Off with the heat. Very dry.
My cooking is very dry. At least I have an excuse now. It's the electric oven.
That's why I didn't come. Yeah. But the natural gas that powers gas ovens these days, especially, is mostly methane. And when you burn methane, it's methane plus oxygen equals carbon dioxide and water.
Uh-huh.
And that comes out as water vapor in the exhaust fumes in the oven. So the heat is much more humid inside the oven, which means that the crust on breads form more slowly and more moistly, and roasts are a lot more moist. But then electric ovens are much better for like things like meringues or chips.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. Chips. There you go.
Chips and meringues.
Chips and meringues.
Dinner.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's why my roast still smells of farts, because you're cooking with methane.
Yeah. Yeah.
I read that only a third of, sorry, this is a big tangent, but only a third of people have methane in their farts.
Oh,
really?
Yeah. Otherwise, it's mostly hydrogen and carbon dioxide.
That's interesting. Yeah. I wonder if a third of people have gas ovens. I wonder if that proportion like tracks out.
Can you imagine if it was a direct correlation?
Well, you know, whenever you see a stat that's like 48% of people like this and 52% of people like this, and we're always like, oh, I wonder if it's down the Brexit lines.
Yeah.
Did any of you grow up with an auger?
No, my grandma had one. So I'm sort of auger au fait, but
that's the poshest sentence you can say.
Exactly.
Au fait with an auger.
We flirted with one for a while.
Did you?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Well, we had one for a while. I hated it.
Yeah,
they really divide opinion. I mean, if anyone doesn't know what they are, like,
sure.
I'd say they're synonymous with the middle class, country home.
Right.
They're this massive iron cast stove.
From Sweden
and they sit in the kitchen. And the idea of them is that they're on all the time, all year round.
Yeah.
Expensive.
Yeah,
they're
very
expensive.
Yeah.
Yeah. So heavy. We lived in a flat.
Yeah.
And they had to reinforce the floor to get the auger. Yeah. It's like, Mum, why do you want an auger so bad?
Apparently, the early ones were like 400 kilograms. Like half a ton in your...
Crazy. This was like a really old... I mean, like, oh my God, my parents. They got it like secondhand and they like renovated it themselves.
Wow.
Like, this doesn't look great, guys.
That's really cool.
And it was so heavy.
Yeah.
Well, they do last forever.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. And Dad was like, it's an investment.
I'm
like, is it? I don't think it is. And like, there's things like we didn't have a toaster.
Right.
And Mum was like, you can use the auger.
Use the auger.
She was like, you can use the auger for everything.
It is multifunctional.
So we had this like weird like netting thing. was kind of like...
My grandparents, it's like a sort of basket, but it's flat.
Yeah, and so you put a piece of toast in and you put it on the top.
Yeah.
I was like, why are we like Amish? Like, it's the 90s. It's not the 1890s.
Well, but that's where the oldest Agra, I think, is from. They tracked down like the oldest Agra in operation.
Oh, yes, the Daily Telegraph did this. Yeah. Did you read this
article?
It's so Daily Telegraph.
What's the country's oldest Agra?
They asked all their readers to write in if you think you've got the oldest Agra in the world. And they found a family in Sussex that had one installed in 1932. So it's 77 years old. It may still be going.
It was still running.
It had to be the oldest continuously operational one.
Well, they were only invented in the 1920s.
So the really interesting story, I know we'll do the history of ovens in a bit, but should we do Agras now? So 1922, a Swedish physicist called Gustav Dahlén, he won the 1912 Nobel Prize for his work on lighthouse technology.
I know, it's a little bit dull, but it's basically like...
I think that's kind of exciting.
Lighthouse technology.
Yeah, it's all shipwrecks and saving, storms. People running up spiral staircases to replace a lamp in the dead of night. I think it's quite dramatic.
I don't know, but he spent a lot of time tinkering in his lab to kind of make sure the gas flow was sort of consistent and not very dangerous.
Yeah,
but
he specifically worked with gas because all the lamps were gas-powered and they had to be really reliable, so he was building gas systems.
But shortly before he won the Nobel Prize, he was blinded in an explosion in his laboratory.
Oh, so it was a sympathy prize. I'll just give it to him.
Lighthouse.
Maybe you're right. I think it was 10 years later he invented the Agra for his poor suffering
wife. He was stuck at home and he was really aware of how much work was going into domestic life, I guess, sitting there listening to your wife, and he realised that it was quite difficult. And
bustling around the kitchen.
Yeah, like when you light the range, you have to tend it and damp it down and clean out the soot and you're always being burnt by it and stuff like that. So he came up with this invention. Yeah. And Agra stands for Atkibulaget Gas Accumulator. R-A-G-A. Agra. It's an acronym. Yeah.
Interesting.
I just thought that it was a word designed to have as many long A vowels in as possible so that you could really prove that you're posh.
Northerners can't say Agra.
Agra, yeah, exactly.
That's interesting. On efficiency, they use 38 times more fuel than a conventional gas or electric oven. But they are on all the time, so all of the waste heat goes to heating your home.
My parents should just not have heating. Which was also stupid because, the kitchen was lovely and warm, the rest of the house freezing.
And also you have to... If it's really hot in summer, you have to turn it off. So it doesn't really make sense to have on all year round. And then it takes like a couple of days to warm up when it finally gets cold enough. So
I think they're an absolute joke. I'm going to be honest. It's ridiculous. I hated it. We got rid of it in the end.
Yeah, I think it's a great one for visiting. I had a couple of posh friends when I was growing up and they had Agras, and it's a nice thing to walk into a kitchen and it's warm. And I remember Rosie grew up with an Agra, and she said that her parents would hang all their school clothes on the Agra to dry and then cook fish in the Agra. So they'd always have to go to school smelling of fish.
That's so unfortunate.
My granny used to put, she had it like an Agra thing. I think it wasn't quite an Agra. It was like
other brands are available.
In Ireland, and she was a farm wife. Is that a thing? Farmer's wife?
Yeah, farmer's wife.
My granddad was a farmer. They were farmers. and
was
she would
so odd if she was a farmer's wife, but he was like an accountant. Yeah. And she was just like such a yokel. Yeah, like, always had a pig next to her.
Like,
yeah.
But we're getting a canary wolf.
But she, But she would, we would like, help milk the cows in the morning and stuff, and then we'd get back for breakfast and she'd put our feet in the oven to warm our feet up.
That's very fairy. Traditionally, what people do in fairy tales before they eat you.
The witch.
They try to put you in the oven feet first.
She was cooking us gradually.
She in the gingerbread house. Okay, it's time for our first lunchbox, and this week that is mine. I've brought you guys beggar's chicken.
Oh, lovely. This is a bit of a makeshift episode because Manu's away and we're in a rush. This is just a cold roast chicken.
This is not what I expected, guys.
A cold roast chicken on a quite dirty baking tray.
Well, this is probably better than an actual beggar's chicken. This is beggar's chicken. It's a very old ancient Chinese dish cooked in basically the first proto oven that we know about.
An early oven.
Very early oven. So this is baked underground.
Oh, wow.
So before we had the sort of clay technology to build ovens, we were digging pits in the ground.
Because before ovens, there was fire. There's just a fire, right? Because we haven't even defined ovens yet.
No, this is true.
An oven is basically like controlled enclosed heat.
Agreed.
So the invention of the oven was
I think people know what an oven is.
Well, we always
have to go out on a limb.
No, but like, from when did the oven begin? What was the first oven? Because, like, you know, if we started off in like prehistoric times, we have evidence of a pit lined with clay from, you know, about 20,000 years ago. Like, that is on some level an oven. And but it's no auger.
And it's a, it's a technological leap from fire, which was itself a technological leap, because fire, you can imagine when you're, you know, toasting marshmallows, if you don't rotate the marshmallow, it all burns on one side. So the advantage of the oven is that the heat comes from all sides.
Yeah.
And the person who thought of that was like, hang on a second, my chicken's cooking on one side and staying raw on the other. Yeah. So it seems intuitive to us, but it took many hundreds of thousands of years.
If fire was the Apple Macintosh, then like a clay-lined pit is the iPod Touch.
Absolutely, right, yeah. And the earliest ones, like we say, were pits in the ground, and then they would slowly get covered. And then eventually people started building the whole thing above ground and then putting them in their homes. So
how is this beggar's chicken cooked then? In the ground?
It's a very old dish that's native to Hangzhou in China. And it's cooked in, basically you wrap it in lotus leaves to retain the moisture. And then you cover it in edible clay. And then you bury it underground with a fire.
Okay.
And then you leave it overnight. And then you dig it up many hours later. And the legend is that there was a beggar who stole a chicken from a farm. And then in order to avoid being captured, you know, with the telltale signs of smoke, he was like, I'll just have to bury it underground and hope this works. And then when he uncovered it the next day, it was delicious and moist and succulent.
And he was a beggar no more.
And he was a beggar no more.
He was rich.
He patented it. He
created an oven.
It's quite an intensive process having to, because what you're doing is building a whole new oven every time you make a meal.
Basically, yeah. I was looking into earth ovens generally, and the Maori have a thing called a hangi, which is basically the same concept, except that you heat rocks on a fire above ground, and then you transfer the rocks into the pit. And these rocks are about 700 to 1,000 degrees Celsius, right? Wow. And they retain heat for a long time because they're made of rock. So they take a long time to heat up, but they also take a long time to cool down. And then you put these rocks in a big pit, and then you cover it with baskets and baskets of food, meat and vegetables. Before the Europeans arrived, it was mostly birds and fish. Nowadays you see a lot of lamb, which is obviously brought from Europe. And then you basically cook like 60 people's worth of food. I read one report of an 1881 hangi for the Maori king, and it had a ton of potatoes, literally a ton.
Whoa.
And 16 pigs, I think.
Whoa.
Oh my God.
And then, you cover it with soil, because the other thing you do is you add wet leaves so that it's sort of steam oven, so it doesn't dry out too much. Yeah, that also protects it from the soil. And then there's someone employed to stand guard and cover up all the steam escaping. So that it
sounds better than an electric oven. Yeah. Why am I doing this?
But there's still
we've got a garden.
So that's pit ovens.
The other ancient civilization that had ovens, of course, the Greeks had ovens, the Egyptians had ovens, the Romans also had ovens. I don't have much to say on them other than that I really like that they invented the pizza oven, and we are still using it today.
Yeah,
I just love
cool.
They
look so old school and like rustic. Though.
Yeah, I was saying next one yesterday in a restaurant, and I actually went to dinner in a restaurant instead of coming to yours.
Unbelievable. With everybody who was going to go to mine.
Yeah, they all turned up.
No, we were working in a restaurant, then we had dinner there afterwards, and there's something so primeval about it. Like, it's so basic.
Exactly,
and seeing the food sliding in and out, it's just really cool that they sorted out that technology like 2,000 years ago and we're still using it. Moving on then to the medieval period, would we say?
Did you guys know that in much of medieval France, it was actually illegal to own your own oven?
What?
Really?
That seems backwards.
Isn't that interesting?
That?
I know. Under the feudal system, baking was the banalité, a banal right.
Is that like, as in the feudal system had like specific rules about...
It's common law, but it's like common and banal.
Yeah. And this was the era when there was like a lord or a seigneur. That's what they were, like all of the provinces had seigneurs. And they were basically the lords, and then they kind of controlled what all of their peasants couldn't go to.
I see.
And so what, they also banned ovens?
Yeah, I mean, you could sometimes pay to have the right to have one, but most of the time it was just banned outright.
Wow. I see.
What did you do? Did you have cold food? Picky bits every day.
Porridge, Alex. Porridge. Cheese.
Bit of cheese, bit of tomato, bit of baguette, some unsalted butter.
No, they had kind of communal ovens. Pay a fee and then use this kind of communal oven.
Of course. It does make sense. I remember staying in the Medina in Fez, which is very medieval, actually, when you go. Like, a lot of the buildings are very old. And they had common ovens as well. So you basically bring your bread dough. I think you had to have sort of shaped it yourself. And you give it to the baker. And then for a small fee, he gives it back to you cooked.
Mm. Especially like a little dress.
Makes
yeah,
sense.
Like a dry cleaner or something.
And it's efficient
yeah.
because, you know, it's quite expensive to run a huge oven. And so, you know, cooking like hundreds of flatbreads in the morning is really, you know, efficient use of firewood.
And also, they probably do a better job than I would.
Yeah, like, true.
I sort of screw it up 9 times out of 10.
And there was obviously the reason is that ovens are a big fire risk, obviously.
Oh, yeah. One big oven is easy to control.
Exactly. And if they could control it.
I bet there was a bit of money involved as well. I bet they quite liked controlling the oven supply.
Yeah,
it's just quite nice, the communal experience as well, going down to the communal oven to get your bread baked.
Yeah, but there's something quite, you're right, there's something quite nice about kind of going down to your local bakery of a morning and queuing up with all your friends and being like, please bake this for me today. I've got people coming around. Yeah. I mean, actually, don't bother because I'll probably cancel. There's something quite nice about that.
Oh God, now I feel like you're into so much effort. You entered this bakery.
I went to the communal bakery.
You were like Belle at the beginning of Beauty and the Beast.
Exactly.
Bonjour. Should we talk about Russian stoves? Because they're amazing.
Aren't they? Did you look at lots of pictures of them?
Yeah, I did.
Yes, I did as well.
Jamie agreed to do this podcast about 2 hours ago.
He just happens to be a big fan of Russian ovens, though, right? It's such a coincidence.
I know all about it. They appear around the 15th and 16th century. No, go on. You guys take the floor.
But they're kind of precursors to Argas, I suppose, because they're designed, Russia's mostly a very cold country, they're huge and they're designed to basically dissipate heat to the whole of the room. Like, they take up half the room.
It's like the house is built around the oven, really.
Yeah.
It's almost like a small building inside the main room of the house.
Yeah,
and they are so much more than an oven. And the whole thing is this kind of massive, like, brick-built system that is also the central heating.
Yes.
It's got a sort of massive area for the fire, but then it's also got loads of different niches and, like, alcoves for keeping different things, like maybe clothes or different herbs and spices that are dried.
Yeah, yeah.
There's also, like, I was reading that, like, you could bathe in it somehow.
Yeah,
I didn't really know how that would work.
Yeah, I read that once the fire's died down, but it's still obviously hot, you put a massive, like, bathtub tray thing. It's like an oven tray for a human.
Yeah.
But, like, you fill it with water and then you take it out once it's warmed up. Right?
Oh, okay.
But there are stories of, like, especially smaller, like, children and toddlers who would actually just bathe in the oven because it was so
that's
cold.
That's so cool.
And, yeah, they cleverly put bunks on top of some of the ovens so you could sleep on top of the oven and the residual heat.
But apparently they're really good at storing heat. So, like, you light a big fire in the morning and, like, the heat is, like, stored in the brick for, like, the whole day.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And what was clever as well is instead of having a chimney that just sucked all the smoke and deposited it outside, it kind of snaked around and was a labyrinthine. It went through lots of brickwork, which just meant by the time it left the house, it had given all that heat to the ambient brickwork. So they used to put ill people inside the oven because they thought that the warm air would cure them, and it obviously did help sometimes. But
it's like going to a sauna.
I suppose,
I know there probably aren't any health benefits of that, but, like, when you're ill, you feel like you want to be in a sauna.
Yeah.
Going forward to the, like, 1700s, you get these, like, proper iron cast iron ovens.
Oh, yeah, people are making them.
The first modern oven, I would say, is when,
maybe for the home as well.
Yeah, and then in 1790, there's a man that you can kind of credit with really improving oven technology. His name was Sir Benjamin Thompson. He was also known as Count Rumford. And he was an 18th century scientist who was obsessed with heat. Like, he did loads of...
E-magazine.
Yeah.
He was a gossip.
Yeah. I think he was renovating a really big house, and he was like, this technology we have with fires and there's smoke going everywhere and the heat dissipates really badly, like, surely we can do better than this. So he develops really, like, top of the range, I was gonna say, pardon the pun. He designed the first recognizable modern kitchen range with circular holes on the top for pots, which each had a different temperature, and one fire powered the whole thing, and you could have something simmering and something boiling, and he had lots of adjustable flues and channels that you actually could control this oven in a really meaningful way. This was completely unheard of in the 1790s. And then he also created the Rumford fireplace, which was, you might recognize it's one of those quite shallow fireplaces that's sort of curved, and they're not very deep, they don't go very far back.
In order not to waste heat, to
reflect the heat back into the room, because before that you'd have a deep fireplace and then all the heat would go straight up the chimney because the chimney was directly above.
Oh, thank you, Count Rumford. Okay, it's time for our second lunchbox, and this week that's Alex's. What have you brought?
I have brought you some baked milk.
Oh, you shouldn't have.
But this is, I should laugh.
I should say, yeah, I should say, it's not say my take on baked milk, but it's actually Manu's take. Oh. I shamelessly stole her lunchbox today. You make it by literally baking milk overnight. So you take a jug of boiled milk and you leave it in an oven, very low temperature, or it's one of those things you could do after you've cooked something in an oven. You
put it
when the oven is cooling down with the residual heat.
That's, I think, what you do with a cheesecake, actually, isn't it?
Really?
That's how you get a nice top. But you have to leave it in while you switch the oven off, and as it cools,
you let it rest and cool naturally.
I have a pretty expensive barbecue. I'm just going to show off it.
You do?
It's a Kamado oven. So if you're familiar with those, you know what they are. But they're basically a really thick bit of ceramic. It's basically like an outdoor oven. You put coals in at the bottom and then it heats up and it keeps the residual heat. But often, and I have a barbecue for my friends, you know, I'll just cook some sausages or burgers or something, and then it'll stay hot for like most of the night.
Oh, that's
and I never
crazy.
Really know what to do with the residual heat.
It seems
heat.
Like a waste, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
Put your feet in it.
Yeah. put my sick grandma in it. Yeah.
You've got a baby, you can have a bath.
Yeah, true. So this is a good use of residual heat. I'm going to make some baked milk for my breakfast.
Yeah. So this is Manu's take on fermented caramelized milk, which is called Ryoshenka. Well, should we try some actually before we crack in?
Oh,
interesting. I don't know. So it's not. It doesn't taste as good as it smells. Sorry.
So not much caramelized.
It's almost like too caramelized.
Oh.
It's a little bit cheesy.
I mean, sorry, Manny. Whatever I was supposed to do with that recipe.
Yeah, if Manny would have made it, it would have been cool.
She would have done it properly. Sorry. I thought this would be a nice way to talk about different ways to use the oven, how we use the modern oven.
Yeah.
The first thing I looked up was the dangers of opening the door when you're cooking something.
Right.
Because I was always taught that, and also Bake Off is always so dramatic about this. Like, if you open the door and you're, say, baking a cake, it ruins it. Everything's ruined.
Sorry.
You mustn't open the door when you're baking a cake.
Is dangerous for your final product rather than your singed eyebrows?
No.
I always worry about that. This is like a pedantic thing, but like, you know when you preheat your oven and it's at the thing, you're like, okay, great. And then you open it to put it in, I'm like, well, it's no longer that.
Yeah. No, I know what you mean.
Really annoys me that
opening the door can drop the temperature of the oven by about 30 degrees.
I don't often use the oven, and part of my feeling is that, like, ovens are all different. You have to kind of get to know your oven. It's the same with pans, I suppose.
Yeah.
But my mum's oven, for instance, like, cooks very slowly. You have to turn it up a bit higher than you need to, because ultimately, like, there is a thermometer in there, but it's on one side of the oven, and so the other side of the oven will be warmer before it triggers to turn off. And then, let's say you put it to 180 and then you turn it down to 160. If it's a well-insulated oven, it won't get to 160 for a long time, unless you open the door, in which case then you overshoot, and then it starts, you know. So it's very inexact science.
It's not a very exact, like, the average domestic oven is not a very good, like, temperature regulator.
No, exactly.
It just turns the heating elements on and off. So it sort of oscillates between, you know, being a bit too hot and a bit too cold, depending on what you set it. And apparently loads of ovens as well, your average domestic oven, like, isn't accurate. When you turn the dial, it's really not going to that temperature. And the big thing is what Rosie said, like, buy a thermometer so that you can actually see what the temperature of your oven inside is.
Yeah.
And then you can compensate.
Yeah.
But you can also apparently recalibrate your ovens. A lot of ovens, you can reset them so that if they run cold, you can change
them. I guess you just need to take the dial out and put it slightly.
Yeah, true. Just moving the dial.
Slightly further around.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I can't remember which ovens it is, but one of the kind of medieval era ovens, how to tell the temperature of the oven was that you threw flour at the inside wall of the oven. And because it's dust and flour is very flammable, it would sort of go up in flames a bit. And it was sort of like a magic trick. But the colour of the flames showed you how hot the oven was. So you got a really good sense.
It's like the traitors.
Yeah.
Oh my God, it's green.
The game's over. We can bake.
Yeah, on to Bake Off.
Traitors X Bake Off. Wow, imagine that. Yeah. Imagine if you had to cook like a cheesecake, but one of you was a traitor and just like poisoned it with something disgusting.
Yeah.
And they were like, who's baked this one?
One of the judges drops dead every time they try one of the dishes.
And I'm sure obviously we're all aware of, in your ovens, you've got the oven, you might have a grill, and then there's a little drawer at the bottom.
For keeping the trays?
No.
Oh, really?
Sure. That's the thing.
What?
That is to keep your food warm. You know, when you're like batch cooking, or like you've got a lot of people going around, you're doing your roast.
Or when you cook a roast and you're waiting for the person to arrive and they never come.
It's still in that bottom drawer. It's still there. We'll be there forever, just to spite you. And you can also like prove dough in there. It's actually part of the oven. It's not just a place to keep shit.
That's like that's when you turn the oven off and it's hot overnight. That's the equivalent of you're using the spare heat.
Exactly.
Yeah. Have you heard of Sabbath mode?
No. Is this like Jewish fashion?
Sabbath a la mode. Yeah. It kind of is. So under Jewish law, you on the Sabbath, you can't do various forms of work.
Right.
So
right.
And that includes you can't ignite a flame, you can't complete an electrical circuit.
So you can't switch your light on.
You can't, you can't cause a device to respond immediately to your actions, basically. So they've come up with these quite... I do find it quite funny, a lot of the Jewish rules, like they're very specific rules about what you can and can't do, and then they're really good at finding ways around that. So you can buy ovens that have a Sabbath mode, which basically means that they run automatically on a Saturday, so you don't have to touch them. Your average oven will like light up, and when you switch it on, and you have to you know turn on the dials, and it will beep when it's done, and you know react to temperature changes. And the Sabbath mode disables all of these reactions, but like the light doesn't go on and off when you open the door because would be interacting with the electrical circuits. Yeah, really interesting. And it just keeps the heat at a steady level that you can cook stuff with it, but you don't have to interact with it.
I just assumed they were Argus.
Yeah, that would be a good solution. Yeah.
That is familiar. I've got a fridge which has a Sabbath mode and I've never tried it, but presumably it's a similar thing. It doesn't like automatically trigger on a Saturday, basically. Yeah. Isn't there that thing around like Manhattan?
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. Have you heard of this?
No.
Well, you might know more than that.
I can't remember what it's called, but basically there's like a literal loophole to the law that if you can't do work on the Sabbath, you can place a special thread in a circle and do work inside of that circle. But there's a whole district in New York where they have erected the biggest one that goes around like 40 city blocks on like telegraph poles. And then they have like a crack team of rabbis on like a cherry picker whenever it breaks and they go up and fix it. And it goes along the street. There are telegraph poles with this cable.
It's amazing.
I can't remember what it's called. Yeah.
Well, I'm a Catholic, and all you have to do is say sorry.
That's actually.
So every religion has their.
At least they're putting the effort in.
Yeah, that's amazing. Setting up these. Not just like, oops, sorry.
Anyway, I thought that was the origin of the word loophole, but actually, it probably isn't true.
It's a literal loophole. Yeah, yeah.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
Do you know where this came from?
The oven glove.
The oven
Alex
mitt.
Alex is holding up an oven glove.
Yeah. An oven mitt.
To me, that's very American.
I agree. This is such an apocryphal story. This is really dumb. But there was, weirdly, a patent for like an oven mitt from the 1870s.
Okay.
I don't really know how you can patent like
a glove. You could patent that specific shape, maybe.
But the most widely credited inventor is a guy called Earl Mitt, who was a baker from New England, who apparently decided to create this thick quilted glove after he burnt himself on hot pans, which I think sounds really unprofessional if you're a baker. I just think it's can't be true
it's
because
too true,
like obviously
it?
It's called an oven mitt because it's like from the word mitten, because it's a mitten.
I'm sure the word mitt existed before.
That comes from like the old French mitin, which is the pet name for a cat, like a kitty.
Yeah.
And mittens were often made of like cat fur. And
so
the word mitten is definitely older than the oven mitt. And that's where the word mitt came from. And I just think that's such a nonsense story about
Earl
Mitt.
Well, I found in 1830 there's a precursor to the oven mitt, which again must have been being used, but there's a book called Chevalier Aldini.
Ooh.
And he wrote a book called Preservation of the Human Body from Destruction by Fire. He describes a double-layered asbestos oven glove. So I think that's probably actually a lot more advanced. Obviously, it's quite dangerous to our lungs.
It's safe in one way.
He's kind of like Thomas Midgley. He wants to save the world and he accidentally just ruins it. Anyway, that does predate Earl Mitt by about a good 40 years.
Yeah.
But like you say.
It's a fraud.
Yeah, Earl Mitt's absolute bullshit.
Okay, it's time for our final lunchbox, and this week that's Jamie's.
Okay, I have roasted you a MacBook. There is a theory, guys, that if your MacBook is... any computer that's very thin, actually, if it breaks and it starts to glitch and stuff, there is a theory that if you put it in the oven, it can restore it.
This sounds like that microwave prank about charging iPhones.
Oh my God, we did this in the microwave episode. Yeah. There was a viral prank that went around that you could charge your phone in 5 seconds by microwaving it.
Loads of people did it, and did it work?
This is the main course to that starter.
So it is a theory. I'm not saying that it's foolproof.
So why would it work? What's going on?
Basically, there are the tiny solder joints that connect up the bits of the major chips inside can sometimes crack.
When it gets old, it's
been like used a lot, and when that happens the laptop may refuse to boot or like glitchy graphics and things like that. Your computer goes a bit mad.
It's heating up loads and then cooling loads and expanding and contracting.
So heating the board close to the solders melts melting point.
Okay.
In theory, temporarily reconnect those microscopic fractures, basically.
Yeah. Oh, so it kind of like everything softens up a little bit.
So if you put it in your domestic oven.
What temperature?
I'd go like 180 fan. 180 to like 220. Don't go mad. It's not Ottolenghi's baked rice.
Stick a USB-C in if it comes out clean. If it's still spongy, then give it another 10 minutes.
So like some people obviously don't put the whole thing in. You can maybe take the motherboard out.
Maybe just the chip. That would make sense.
But people really have oven baked their dead laptops.
Well, this has worked on occasion.
Revived them.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Okay. It's a bit like last week we handed out advice that was like, if you get methanol poisoning, just drink loads of vodka. And it's like in extremis, it doesn't always work.
Yeah, we should say Lunchbox Envy is not liable for your hardware if you do this.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a reliable fix. Yeah. I mean, technically it should work, but, you know, professionals do advise against it.
Well, I think
it's a racket and they want the work. Yeah. So bake your laptops, everyone.
But I think they do along the same lines. If you're trying to restore like something and you just need it to work for a little bit and you take in your laptop, they will heat up all those soldering elements and soften them on. So they are doing the same thing.
That is what they do,
but
exactly.
But under control conditions.
And more targeted, exactly,
They're not just like whacking it in the argon. That would be so funny if you go to one of those like beautiful white Apple stores and in the back they've just got a farmer's wife with an argon heating up all of it.
Charcoal burner at the back.
Burying it underground, wrapping in leaves.
But I just thought that was like a fun way to talk about some unusual ways you can use an oven.
Yeah,
and things you can cook in ovens.
Well, should we talk about Charles Babbage, which we mentioned at the top?
Oh, yeah.
Who cooked himself.
Yes.
This was in the 1840s. Charles Babbage, the inventor, one of the grandfathers of computing.
Pioneers of the computing industry.
He once tried to cook himself in an oven.
Why?
Did he want to like channel being a computer? He was like, I am the computer.
He became fascinated by the idea that meats that cook at a very low, slow temperature and have a better flavour and a better texture. So he carried out this series of experiments and published them in a treatise.
Wow.
And one of them was he wanted to test whether humans could tolerate these kind of low, slow cooking conditions. Still pretty high temperatures, I've got to say. So he climbed in and out of the bread oven that was about 120 degrees Celsius.
120?
Wow.
That's so hot.
That is like a hot, hot sauna.
That's about boiling point.
No. I think he stayed in for like 5 or 6 minutes at a time.
Wow.
They didn't close the door. So
it wasn't that temperature, was it? It was at least 30 degrees lower.
I think it was probably quite close, actually, though, because I think, you know, it was a bread oven. So I think maybe compensating for the open door.
Yeah, wow.
He said it was uncomfortable but tolerable and he emerged without injury.
But did he not like emerge a super genius or like able to run 100 meters in 5 seconds?
Glowing red. No, he was probably delicious though.
Just think
al dente.
But yeah, it turns into one of the earliest, tests on human heat tolerance.
I guess. You know, and famously, like to get around ethics committees, you can always do the experiment on yourself.
Yes.
Right.
Like
there was the guy who injected himself with, he gave himself stomach ulcers or something.
That was it.
Some kind of penicillin. He gave himself stomach ulcers so he could then cure them.
Yeah.
That's really backing yourself, isn't it?
It really is.
I think you should have to do that, actually.
Yeah,
I think
maybe.
That should be mandatory.
That's true, actually.
If you really believe in this thing, prove it on yourself, not on some little mouse.
That's a good point.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was trying to disprove this widespread belief that meat needed to be seared at really high temperatures. So really what he was doing was a cooking experiment, but for some reason he decided to do it on himself.
He was anti-Maillard, wasn't he?
Yeah, he's so anti-Maillard. Ooh. Which is a fun activity for the night.
I guess at the end you'd have braised red Babbage.
Very good.
There's the outro.
Very strong.
So we're recording this in North London. Where do you think the furthest away oven is to us right now?
Ooh.
The furthest away oven.
Maybe like the Arctic. Is there like an oven in the Arctic for the polar explorers?
Is there an oven on like the space station in some way?
Oh, that's a good one, yeah.
Further.
Further?
Further than the space station.
The moon. Mars. We've been to Mars.
Mars is the answer. The Curiosity rover has a little oven on it for baking soil samples to dry them out.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah, it's very small. Okay. Curiosity rover was launched in 2012, wasn't it? And it has a very tiny oven that's about the size of a thimble.
That's funny.
It's only little.
Yeah, it's called SAM, Sample Analysis at Mars, which sounds like a bit of a crowbarred acronym.
Yeah, they love crowbarred acronyms.
Yeah, right now, they do. But it contains tiny quartz and steel cups that heat Martian soil and rocks to nearly 1,000 degrees. Like, it's hotter than a pizza oven.
Babbage would never survive.
Babbage, R.I.P.
I'm imagining a slight kind of, like, you know, like Wallace and Gromit, two mechanical arms with oven mitts on. Yes, like, taking a tray and putting it inside yourself, like Wally. Is that what it's like?
I hope that's the first alert that any potential life on Mars is that they hear the ding and they're like, oh, yeah, what's this magical noise?
It'll burn. Quick, take it out.
What's that lovely smell?
It's baked milk.
Oh, no, it's grandma. It's grandma.
Have you guys heard about using a dishwasher to cook things? Well, no, but like, if you think about it, a dishwasher is obviously a heating device.
That's true.
Yeah.
It gets between like 50 and 70 degrees Celsius.
Okay.
It's, you know, decent. So you can like poach things in there. It's quite famous for poached salmon.
Oh, really?
It's like dishwasher poached salmon. It's
what, like, in like some Tupperware? You'd have to wrap it up.
Yeah,
really
you have to like seal it, obviously. Yeah. But if you just like whack it in there with your mugs and your whatever.
Is the purpose of an oven to sort of, is it defined by the temperature range or is it about culinary?
I think what we definitely should do is do a dishwasher's episode and cook some salmon. I think that's a great idea.
Yeah, we should.
Yeah. Have you guys heard of the Easy Bake Oven?
I have. I've never known what it is. I always thought it was like a toy.
It is. It's such an American thing. It's like the thing that they've made a reference to on every American sitcom.
Yeah, right.
It was like a classic toy. It was launched in 1963. So it was like a long-running toy. The idea is that it was sort of safe to cook things
in. Yeah, it's like my first oven or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Kids do love kitchen shit.
They do. Yeah. But the original one were powered by an incandescent 100-watt bulb because those incandescent bulbs are so inefficient that only 5% of the energy goes out to light. Yeah. So what they did was they literally a sort of toy oven, and inside was a simple circuit with a light bulb, which was inside a box. Wow. And that just radiated so much heat that you could actually cook, not proper meals, but you could bake little brownies and cakes. But they're still being made today. And they've obviously designed a proper heating element these days. But
surely kids are all on Fortnite these days.
Yeah, you're right. Food in from Deliveroo,
yeah, that's really cool.
I was looking up some of the world's oldest ovens, and there's one in a bakery in Greece that's run by a husband and wife team today. It's like a set of wood fire ovens that they think were lit for the first time in 1420.
No,
wow.
Henry V sat on the English throne. The Byzantines rule Constantinople.
Oh,
I know.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
I can believe many things.
There are so many of these places. It's like the oldest restaurant ever, and it's like you have no paper trail to prove that.
That's true.
On historical ovens, the first flat I ever lived in London had a really horrible freestanding white metal cooker from kind of like the, I guess like 70s or 80s. Okay. Like really gross and horrible with exposed coils.
Oh,
like
I remember those.
It was really gross. And I was only like 18 or something. And I remember realizing I have to move when I went to the Science Museum for a day and I saw the same oven in a historic exhibition of like old ovens from
this
history.
This is how we used to cook.
Yeah, it was.
Okay, that's it for this week's edition of Lunchbox Envy.
You can follow Lunchbox Envy socials for foodie facts and podcast updates on X, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok at Lunchbox Envy Pod.
That's right, and you can also get in touch and send us your facts, recipes, questions by emailing us lunchbox@qi.com. Thank you so much for stepping in, Jamie.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me. It's been really fun.
Will you come back?
No, but I've learned.
Is there anything we can plug in return?
Well, actually, yes.
Oh.
Seeing as it's Christmas, my dad wrote a porno. We used to do a Christmas special every single year.
Oh my God, it was the highlight of my Christmas.
Honestly, I know that I made it, but like they're so funny. And they're all available wherever you get your podcasts. So I would say if you're in the festive spirit and fancy a bit of a laugh while you're cooking or wrapping presents or things, listen to some of the Christmas specials of my dad wrote porno. They are brilliant.
It's so nice to be able to support little struggling podcasts.
It would be great, wouldn't it?
All right, that is it. We will see you next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Lunchbox Envy was hosted by Jamie Morton, Jack Chambers, and produced by Alex Bell. This has been a quite interesting podcast.